and start the meeting. I'd like to call to order that at this time, I have 8:31. And it's October 23rd, 2019.
Hi, have you called in? Okay, she is in the process of calling in this very second.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to just go ahead and do the opening statements. Today's October 23rd, 2000.
We didn't do a roll call.
Oh, yeah, we need a roll call. Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Here.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Again, this is October 23rd, 2019, and I call the meeting of Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 32-2081H, may dismiss a complaint appearing on this agenda or refer it to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081H1. Upon a vote of majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session for any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431.03A2 to review confidential records, or A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon parties present and requests to speak. A person or a representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and who is present may make a brief statement to the committee by filling out a request to speak form and giving it to a board member in person. The committee may also have questions for those that speak. And this part's very important. Please only use initials when referring to patients or children. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in public meetings. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential information. The first complaint that we will be reviewing today is number 19-10 for Shelley Kaufman. Dr. Myers, you are the lead, I believe, on this case.
Check and see who just came on the line.
Yes, good morning. This is Charles Struble, and Dr. Kaufman is here in my office with me. We're both here.
Okay, is this not in order then? The first one on our agenda is Metoya.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go through the agenda.
Let's ask.
Okay. Which one should I go?
Let me see. May I just double check, is Dr. Metoya on the line?
I am. Good morning.
Very good.
All right. Then we're going to go ahead and stay with the agenda. Sorry, my notes were a little confusing. So our first case, I'm sorry, is 20-04, Dr. Mentola. And Dr. Bohansky, you are the lead on this case. If you'd like to introduce the case.
Sure. I'll do a brief introduction. We have a complaint filed by AB against Dr. Mentola, license number 4142. The complaint revolves around a neuropsychological evaluation which Dr. Mentola conducted following referral from a neurologist. Dr. Mentola works in the Banner University Health System, as does the neurologist involved. The complainant and his neurologist were concerned about some cognitive changes or potential thereof, and Dr. Mentola was retained to perform an evaluation. Following that evaluation, the report was reviewed by the patient, who is the complainant, and he found what he believed to be concerns and discrepancies within the report. He brought the issue to the university, to his neurologist, to the doctor, for changes to be made, and just in brief, some of the concerns he had. First, I think it was a very personal one. He's a highly educated individual, and was somewhat concerned that he wasn't referred to as doctor in the report, but rather as mister. He was further concerned that in the process of the neuropsychological evaluation, Dr. Mentola accessed clinical records, his health records, his background and information, and he felt that use of that might be inappropriate. He was concerned at some errors in the report in terms of his background, use of the word services or force in terms of his military experience in Israel, and several other errors that he felt were there. The university and Dr. Montoya responded with some edits that were provided in addendums that were there. However, the complaint is before us here today.
Right, thank you. Is AB here? If you'd like to come forward, please. Oh, just have a seat right there. That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you for being with us, AB.
Sure.
And again, I'm just using initials.
That's okay.
If you would like to provide a brief statement to the board, and then we may have some questions for you.
Okay. The statement I'll make that the summary of my detailed complaint was not quite on point. What I was concerned about is not only the invasion of disclosing medical records were totally inaccurate, but making interpretations that are totally uncalled for. And the most important thing is Dr. Machado did not do the evaluation at all. She was not present at all. Only the medical, she was a third year graduate student. She did the entire evaluation, the entire testing. I only saw Dr. Machado for a couple of minutes at the beginning of the session. Some of the statements were outrageous, totally. And I was a research professor at the Baylor College of Medicine. I'm familiar with research methodology. So, and I prepared a very detailed four-page report on that. And I'm concerned that if this is a pattern, in my age, I'm 72, it won't make any difference. My record is well established. My history is well established. But what happens to somebody that happens to somebody who's much younger? And this is a it's on public records.
Thank you. And we've all read all the documentation.
I
so
know,
that's,
I know,
yeah.
But
so
the way I heard the doctor summarize it was not in order of importance that I emphasize.
And we appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. And are there any questions?
I don't have any.
So let me just confirm. Yeah, so your testimony is that you're in essence that it's the doctor was not part of the evaluation. Can you tell us, explain what exactly, what part of the evaluation she was part of?
For the first 2 minutes, the graduate student, she was a third year PhD student. She took me to the room. The doctor, the scout was sitting in the corner, introduced the graduate student and left. And I have not seen her the rest of the day.
So the graduate student took all the history,
the evaluation. She had really a terrible time administering some of the tests. Another thing, the neurologist referred me for cognitive loss, not intellectual functioning. I mean, my record speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. And she did not address it at all. And the IQ test, basically for the IQ test, was totally inappropriate, first of all, because of my ADD. Like 3 years ago, when I was at Baylor College of Medicine, I had one of the psychologists give me the test. I couldn't do anything with it. About as bad as I performed 3 months ago.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you coming forward. If you'd like to take a seat, that would be great.
Thank you.
I believe Dr. Montoya is on the phone and is represented by Dr. Akins.
Yes, I'm here.
Would you like to introduce yourselves, please, and if you'd like to make a statement?
My name is Dr. Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee, and I know she would like to introduce herself and has a few words for you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Bohansky, and thank you, members of the Complaint Screening Committee, for this opportunity to address this complaint. My name is Marisa Menchola. I have never before had a board complaint. I have never before had a patient complain about my work to me or to my supervisors. And I believe that my evaluation and my report in this case conform to professional standards of practice and ethics. But I have taken these complaints very seriously. I addressed them promptly, and I immediately sought consultation to make sure that my response to the complaints also conformed to our professional ethical standards and my institution's policies. There are three aspects to this complaint that I would like to address briefly.
Please.
First, regarding the very serious claim of inaccurate billing, I want to again emphasize that my billing accurately reflected the professional services that I provided. I was, in fact, present for the whole clinical interview. I conducted a chart review, I interpreted the test data, and I wrote the report. And my billing accurately and clearly, I believe, reflected these activities and the time I spent on them. Second, regarding the claims of multiple inaccuracies on the report, I did not include any information that was not either provided by the complainant during the interview or that was included in his medical record. There were three specific inaccuracies regarding his occupational background that I corrected promptly through an addendum, but I do not have the ability to change the medical information on his record. And finally, regarding the complaints about the methods I used in my evaluation and the way I derived my conclusions, many of these complaints reflect a misunderstanding of the methods or disagreement with methods that are, in fact, standard practice for a neuropsychological evaluation, things like reviewing the medical history, assessing daily life functional abilities, and interpreting the raw test scores. I understand that the complainant disagrees with my methods and with my conclusions, but the methods I used are standard procedures for neuropsychological evaluations and conform to professional practice standards. I sincerely wish that the complainant had reached out to me directly and allowed me to address these concerns. I really wish I had the opportunity to assure him that he received good care. I completed a thorough evaluation. I conducted his evaluation with care and in accordance with practice standards. I believe that the facts in this complaint show that even if the complainant disagrees with my conclusions, I in no way violated our professional ethical standards. And so I would like to again respectfully request that this complaint be dismissed. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, Doctor. Do we have any follow-up questions?
Yes, this is Dr. Bohansky.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for appearing. How much time did you spend interviewing Dr. Abey?
We started the interview at 9:30 and ended at 10:45 in the morning. So the interview took an hour and 15 minutes. And perhaps to clarify, the way we do it, when I have a student rotating through my clinic, the student conducts the interview and I'm in the room, and at certain points at the end of each section of the interview, the student knows to check with me to see if I have additional questions to ask. So the student will go over the current complaint questions and then ask me, do you have any additional questions? I'll ask questions. They'll go through the medical history and so on.
Did you take notes of this interview?
I did.
And they reflect the amount of time that you were in that interview?
My notes include the notes that I took while I was in the room for every section of the interview through the very end. The last section we cover is the person's current emotional functioning. I have notes for that section. And it also documents that the interview ended at 10:45 in the morning.
I saw that as I reviewed them. Doctor, you're a ABAP certified specialist in neuropsych?
Correct.
And you're an employee of Banner University Medical Center?
Correct.
And you were providing this evaluation at the request of a neurologist from that medical center?
Yes.
Is this the type of evaluation, or let me start, have you done this type of evaluation for the neurology service there before?
Yes, absolutely.
Is there any difference in this evaluation substantially from answering the type of referral questions you get from neurology?
No, this is a pretty standard, this is a type of evaluation that I routinely complete for my neurologist colleagues.
Thank you. What were your conclusions in brief?
My conclusion, my conclusion.
No diagnosis.
No diagnosis.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question, please?
Without giving a diagnosis, what were your conclusions?
Sure. My conclusion was that overall, this patient's cognitive profile suggested pretty broad decrease in their functioning from their estimated baseline levels. However, this decrease did not meet criteria for a specific diagnosis of a neurocognitive disorder.
Great. Thank you. I'm done with questions.
Dr. Myers, any questions?
Yes, thank you. Dr. Manchoya, this is Dr. Meyer.
Good morning.
Good morning. The one question I have is how the claimant could have felt that you were not present there for the entire interview. He states that you left after just a brief introduction. Did you leave the room and come back? Did you stay there the whole time? Can you provide any insight on this inconsistency?
Yeah, I really wish I could. Not only do I have my notes showing that I was present and took my own notes during the interview, but in fact, I remember this interview. I, for example, remember when we were going through the occupational history, asking specific clarification questions. I mean, I really wish I could help clarify this discrepancy. I don't think I can other than to say that, you know, I have my notes and I have my own memories of being present for the whole interview and, as usual, excusing myself at the moment the testing was going to start. I do not recall leaving the room at any point during the interview, and I don't see any gaps in my notes that would suggest that I was not present for a specific portion of the interview.
Okay, thank you.
Doctors, is Tamara Shreve, I'm the chair. Just a quick question, just physically in the room, was there any situation where he wouldn't have been able to see where you were sitting?
I don't believe so. The way that it's a small room, the way it is set up, there's you know, the patient is on one side of the desk, the student sits immediately exactly in front of the patient across from them on the desk, and I sit sort of behind and to the side of the student, so that I can see the patient and their family member if they're present. So given the setup, no, there's really no way their vision would have been completely blocked, so that they could have missed me.
All right, I just wanted to clarify all that. All right, thank you. Are there any
of course, you're welcome.
Are there any further questions? All right, not hearing any further questions. And thank you, Doctor, and Mr. Aitken for coming forward and participating, and for AB for participating. This is a time where the committee is now going to go into deliberations. Please note that deliberations is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from the complainant, licensee, or the attorneys representing the licensee. Dr. Bohansky, you're the lead on this case. Would you like to start the deliberations?
I'd be happy to. Certainly there's some things I can't answer and don't know that anyone can answer. It's a perception as to whether someone was in the room or was not in the room. I have notes that reflect that someone was there, certainly taking notes as the interview progressed, so there is documentation that's there. I have reviewed extensive pages of billing information, graphs and charts and codes. I found that stuff to be appropriate and not out of line. University medical-based hospitals
I think are used to those types of procedures and procedural codes. This would not be the type of thing that the individual doctor, per se, would be doing. I've reviewed the neuropsych evaluation. It's the type of evaluations that psychologists participate in, especially neuropsychologists who have a specified training and have a certificate of specialization or competency in this area. The evaluation procedures used appear to be appropriate. They appear to be the type of evaluations that a neuropsychologist would perform in answering the questions or clarifying issues for the referring neurologist. I do see and certainly agree with Dr. A.B. that, and I've experienced it myself in going to healthcare providers where I get called Mr. and I'm a little miffed that I'm not doctor. I would complain about that and have, except at the Mayo Clinic where they always make sure they do that right during my physical. The other complaints that I saw as perhaps an understanding issue, is it routine to use a psychometrician or graduate student in training for the actual testing portions? That's the standard practice in the field. And I believe that doctor has been supervising for some time students doing that type of testing. The student is not allowed to do the interpretation of the testing. The doctor does that. The next part of complaint that I looked at with that is those test results are taken in light of the medical history. That's normal to be combining that information in an effort to explain any of the findings that are there or better understand the findings that are there. Certainly that information is available, and in the consent forms for the evaluation it notes that that happens. So I was less concerned about that issue as being there. Were there a couple factual things? Doctor is a very, very intelligent man who's had an incredible career and should be thanked for the service he's provided, in my opinion, working in the Israeli military, and whether it was special services or special forces, any civilian could make that mistake in terms of writing it, even in attentional thing themselves in taking notes. So, and that was corrected. That could be corrected. I would note that doctor's correct when she reviews records that she has and the medical record that she was reading and quoting from, she has no right to change. That's another doctor's notes. I cannot go in and change another doctor's notes. I can quote from it, I can question it, I can respond to it, I can incorporate it, but I can't change it. What I can change is a mistake I make in my notes, and I think doctor noted that appropriately. So those are the views I had when I reviewed it.
Dr. Myers?
I agree. The evaluation I felt was appropriate. I felt Dr. Manchoya responded appropriately to the concerns from AB, and there is no evidence to indicate that the entire assessment wasn't done correctly. So I don't see substantial concern.
And I would agree with both my colleagues. I think you both have, and Dr. Bohansky finally pointed out, you know, the doctor's incredible, great background, you know, the errors, the technical errors were changed in the report, and again, you can't change prior doctor's assessments. Is there any motion or further discussion?
You know, the only thing I do is just to assure that we have hundreds of pages we review. We do that independently and cannot talk amongst ourselves before this point in time. So independently, we've come to a similar conclusion, which leads me to a comfort level of moving to dismiss.
Okay, so I have a motion to dismiss. Is there a second?
Seconded.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposing? Hearing none, the motion moves forward. I'd like to thank both parties for being present today and participating.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if we may go to agenda item 3C for Dr. Mastikian's case,
Dr. Mustakian and his attorney are present here today.
Sure. We'll move then to complaint number 2005. That is Dr. Mustakian. I am the lead on that. I'll provide a brief summary. On July 29th, 2019, the board office received a court minute entry dated July 24th, 2019 from the Honorable Scott Blaney of the Maricopa County Superior Court regarding a family court case. In the minute entry, and I'll summarize, it says that father had submitted had made a motion for the mother to undergo a psychological evaluation, and that a consultation summary that was offered by Dr. Mustakian was entered. It's dated May 3rd, 2019. It goes on to state that he met with the father to hear the father's complaints, the doctor did, regarding mother, with whom he's involved in a family court case. The probability is high that she may be, and the doctor, in essence, had a conclusion that she may, the mother, have underlying untreated trauma conditions, which may be maintaining a very strict and dysfunctional personality characteristics, and then he suggests a certain personality characteristic. According to the court minutes that the judge submitted, the doctor never interviewed mother before arriving to his potential diagnosis of her, and that it appears that he relied solely on father's one-sided narration. Stated in there that in his report that it was not to be used as a diagnosis tool. The report was created for the purpose of litigation and was filed with the court in support of father's motion for mother to undergo psychological evaluation. The court questions whether the report and potential diagnosis of the litigant, whom Dr. Mustakian, thank you, has never met, was within the ethical bounds of practice and licensing. The licensee did respond in a timely manner through his attorney. The doctor says he did meet in person with the father in April of 2019 for a consultation regarding the father's concerns about mother. That the doctor informed the father of his limits of confidentiality because the information provided by father during the interview would be included in the written summary. The doctor indicates that the consultation summary was not a diagnosis and that it included a notice as such. Also, the doctor, the doctor had no reason to believe the father was not participating in good faith, he states that he prefaced his comments regarding mother with the assumption that father's report was accurate and noted in the consultation summary that it was based on father's report. Doctor does not believe that he violated any board rules, statute, or APA. He cites the APA code, section 9.01B. stating that psychologists provide opinions on the psychological characteristics of individuals only after they have conducted an examination of the individuals adequate to support their statements or conclusions. And also 9.01, when psychologists conduct a record interview or provide consultation or supervision of an individual, examination is not warranted or necessary for an opinion. Psychologists explain this and the source of information in which they base their conclusions and recommendations. Also, doctors stating that the consultation report was prepared as a litigation matter and should be afforded protection pursuant to litigation privileges. And that concludes my summary. Since I am the lead, I'll start with the questions. And thank you again. If you could introduce yourselves.
If you want to make a statement.
Yeah, that's good. If you'd like to introduce yourselves and make a brief statement.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. I'm Natalia Turgregorian, and Dr. Mustakian is seated to my left. And I would appreciate the opportunity just to briefly address the issues in the complaint and Judge Blaney's minute entry. As board member Sharif pointed out, the complaint was based on Judge Blaney's referral based on the fact that there was no interview and based on the fact that he perceived the consultation summary to be some sort of a potential or a diagnosis of mother, when in fact we see in the APA in section 9.01C, which is the exception that is incorporated, that psychologists are permitted to conduct consultations, and they're permitted to do so without always interviewing the subject, so long as the limitations are expressly set forth, and that they're, and in this case, Dr. Mastikian did that. He explained that, you know, the conclusions and the statements in the consultation summary were based exclusively on CH's presentation of facts, which he understood to be their, you know, delivered and presented to him in good faith, and that they were genuine and honest observations. But he does have that disclaimer saying, hey, this report, this consultation summary, this is based on what CH has presented. I did not interview mother. I did not interview any other records. And this is the limited set of facts on which this report is based. And this report does not contain any diagnosis of mother. We're simply here to say whether or not, based on the facts represented by father, that there are any mental health conditions that could be consistent with this, whether there are any symptoms that are consistent with what the facts that are being presented. And it is evident from the minute entry that this was a highly contentious child custody case, and that Judge Blaney was apparently frustrated with definitely father, possibly both parties, but the judge admittedly did not investigate whether or not the consultation summary complied with the ethical and professional standards when he referred this matter to the board. And while Dr. Mastikian understands the judge's concern, we believe that the APA section 9.01C does permit the specific type of consultation that was conducted here. And this isn't dissimilar from the types of consultations that Dr. Mastikian provides to the Department of Child Safety when they present a limited record or limited facts and without necessarily interviewing all of the subjects involved. There's a request to provide some sort of a statement or a conclusion based on the facts that are presented. And so long as the limited universe of facts on which those conclusions and statements are based are disclosed, which they were in this case, we believe that that does comply with the professional and ethical standards. The one other point that I wanted to add is that in any time a complaint is filed against a licensee, I think it provides a licensee an opportunity to review processes and protocols and ensure that, see if there's any room for improvement in terms of anything that is being done. And in this particular case, it was noted that there was no, even though there was implicit consent because of the communication with the attorneys and verbal consent due to, based on the limited confidentiality with CH, there was no signed consent. So I just want to make the board aware that since then, Dr. Mastikian and his office has implemented additional safeguards to ensure that a consent is, a written consent is obtained in every case. So now there's a slightly modified process to ensure that that happens as well. And Dr. Mastikian is here and available to answer any questions.
Thank you. All right, so I will start with questions. So if you could, we've all read the report. You met with this gentleman, and what was your, what did you think you were doing a report for?
There was a custody case in family court. The gentleman was referred to me by his attorney to find out if there was more, if there was enough evidence to warrant concern about the child involved and the mother's alleged behaviors, to file a motion to conduct a full psychological evaluation. That's the whole purpose.
All right, and in this, you, he provides a lot of his version of her personality, and then at the, and it specifically says in there that there's no history of going to a psychologist, there's no history of mental health issues, as far as professional history, you know, going to a psychologist or mental health facility. So everything's based on what he says. But at the end, you do provide you do say that Mr. H is being her primary target, all of which could be evident of a, and then it gives a disorder. and I don't want to say it in public because it's, but you provide a what I would consider a diagnosis. Is that not what, how would you other interpret that?
I referenced the characteristics, you know, strictly based on what he mentioned about her, and if there's enough to say there's characteristics of it, I make reference to that and say that, that I would suggest that these characteristics be further explored in an evaluation.
So based on what was said, could the characteristics have been depression, or could have been other types of mental health issues?
It could have been.
But you went to one specific one that was pretty substantial. And let me just clarify, I represent the general public. I'm not a psychologist. These two gentlemen are psychologists. So, you know, it's from my opinion, it's a pretty substantial character, you know, representation of what you think those characteristics are. How do you justify that?
I compared everything that he told me to various criteria in the DSM-5, and I, in my mind, went in the direction of this is it's not a definitive diagnosis, but there's characteristics of the impression that I have. There are elements of depression as well, but those elements of depression can be subsumed under a severe personality disorder as well. So I'm trying to say I'm not diagnosing the individual, but there are hallmark characteristics that, based on what you reported, just very characteristic of a personality disorder.
So in the APA code, it says psychologists provide opinions of a psychological characteristic of individuals only after they have conducted an examination of the individuals adequate to support their statement or conclusions. You met with one person. You met with a person that you knew they were in a litigation situation, correct?
Yes.
So do you think potentially his views could be slanted, his opinion?
I believe I make reference to that throughout the report.
So knowing that, do you feel as though you conducted an examination of the individuals adequate to support those statements? And it's individuals, plural.
Okay, not only did I take into account whatever he provided, but he also provided various text messages and whatnot that he provided after I met with him. The attorneys provided to me, so I put it all together. And, you know, they're very limited. There's very limited information. But, again, the objective is to clarify what we see through a more comprehensive and objective evaluation. That's the whole point.
Board member, I'm so sorry, if I may. Just the portion that you just quoted a second ago starts out with except as noted in 9.01C, which is the section that, the subsection, I should say, that addresses consultations as opposed to.
Right, but then that's the exception.
Correct.
Right, so there's an exception to it.
Right.
Right.
And
so
we believe that the consultation summary in this case qualifies under that exception because it had that language about this is based on the limited information and this is based on not having examined. There was not having examined mother and on, you know, the information provided by father. And it wasn't a glowing report of father either. There was, you know, there were statements that they both appeared to have a dysfunctional relationship and that he had characteristics that.
But there wasn't any, so in that you're right in that case. So why didn't you make any assumption about father in the recommendation?
Well, the consultation was on the mother, but I do make reference to the father having some dysfunctional qualities as well.
But there's no summary of his characteristics.
But the consultation was on the mother, not on him.
Yes.
It's a hard balance out, but again, the purpose of this whole consultation was his concerns about the mother and the child and so forth. So,
okay. I have no further questions, Dr. Wilkins. Do you have questions?
Me? Disclosure, probably 10 years ago, I think I had you in a class. But I've had no business relationship or contact with him since. He was a student in a class of mine, and I'm going to go back into a teaching mode. Consultations are fine. You can do all kind of consultations. And they should result in recommendations that are clear. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with providing, under the exception, consultations in which it's clear I didn't do a full evaluation, but there's a concern, especially when we're talking about the welfare of a child. That's the primary issue in any custody case, is the welfare of a child. So if information comes to me and there's some evidence and there's some hyper concern and a court asks me, what do you think? I would probably suggest that, not stating a diagnosis, but there's significant evidence to suggest an evaluation is in order. Not what I am looking for. I wouldn't want to lead somebody to that diagnosis. Not what I think it is, because I haven't done the evaluation. But there's a significant amount of information here that concerns me enough for the welfare of this child to do that. So that would be my teaching moment in terms of how I would write that. In terms of what you wrote, it's a very powerful and prejudicial statement. Mm-hmm. And that is always of concern. And now, why you would make a powerful statement, as I understand your testimony, you're saying it's because after reviewing the criterion that you did, the behaviors described to you best fit that. And I understand that. But it's kind of like some of these yahoos on TV telling me what Trump has wrong with him without ever sitting down and interviewing him. I think that's called the Johnson rule. It's one of them legal things you attorneys talk about all the time. And that frustrates me when I see colleagues make those kind of statements in any situation. If I'm concerned about the welfare of a child, and a dad comes to me and he's concerned about the welfare of his child, and he talks about stuff that's going on that's not in the best interest of the child, the judge asks me, what do I think? I'd probably say, let's do an evaluation or a reevaluation. I can't believe in a contentious court situation. There already wasn't a custody evaluation. But some of these things drag on, and it might be time for a new one. And if you hear that stuff and you see that stuff, you tell the judge, yeah, there's enough going on here that I'm concerned. Perhaps without putting a label. That's the one error that I'm concerned with. That's my
Dr. Myers?
Dr. Mastikin, and also disclosure, I've reviewed records of yours for disability determination services. But no direct contact in years. The same concerns about that. My one question would be, your attorney stated that you are now implementing a consent form. Has that not been done before?
Let me clarify. Can I just clarify? Because I think I misspoke. They revised. They did have a protocol in place before to obtain consents, but Dr. Mastikian would have the consent forms in his possession when clients came in, and he would, you know, provide the proper consent to each client. Now what they do is they've slightly revised that so that his assistant provides the forms in the waiting room and gives the person an opportunity to review them. If they feel comfortable to sign them there, and then she reports that the consent has been signed, and if not, then that's the first thing he does when they walk in is, you've now been handed some consent forms, let's talk about them and let's see if you have any questions and sign those.
So was there a consent form?
There, not in this particular case, because, and Dr. Mastikian can explain it better than I, but the CH kind of dove right in and it didn't get done in this isolated incident.
Okay. No other questions, thank you.
Any other questions?
No, ma'am.
All right, thank you very much for appearing. We're now gonna go into deliberations. Again, deliberations is time for the panel to review all the evidence and discuss amongst themselves without interruption from any of the parties. I'll go ahead and start. I do have strong concerns, I guess, about this, and I think Dr. Bohansky maybe pinpointed it in the sense that, well, I guess what concerned me the most was that there was a diagnosis made of characteristics of a certain diagnosis, where as opposed to, as you really said, hey, there's enough concern maybe that warrants a evaluation. This wasn't a judge-ordered consultation. This was the father going in, raised concerns, and again, the children are the first and foremost issue on anything. But I guess what concerned me, especially as the general public, is that there is a person goes in, talks about another person, and there's just characteristics of this potential disorder. And that I found a little concerning, and yet Section 9.01C, which you're stating that they can provide consultation and supervision, it says, and an individual examination is not warranted or necessary for opinion. For that kind of an opinion or conclusion, I would think you'd need to have, you know, met with that individual. So, you know, again, it wasn't a sense of, hey, I think I see enough issues here, maybe you want to suggest an evaluation. There was some actual potential characteristics of certain diagnoses, which I thought was going, which is a step beyond what I think is I'm comfortable with. And I think does not, I think the law does talk about it is, an individual examination is not warranted or necessary. I think it was warranted for that kind of a statement. Those are my thoughts. Any other thoughts from the board?
I mean, I agree with those, that there shouldn't have been a recommendation of a specific disorder. The sole recommendation should have been there's evidence that an evaluation would be beneficial. And then the concern about a consent form. Those are my concerns.
Dr. Bohansky?
You know, I don't want to fight over words, but I guess it's that time of the meeting. The probability is high that you may have an underlying and untreated such and such condition, which may be maintaining very distinct and dysfunctional characteristics suggestive of such and such disorder, which would be explained by erratic and intense fluctuations and what have you. Based on Mr. reporting, and that's the qualifier that's there, it ends up with Mr. being her primary target. He's the reception of her behaviors, which he's trying to explain, all of which could be evidence of such and such a disorder. So, you know, when I, and by the way, I'm also going to say there's a history of other diagnostic conditions for the father noted as well. Mm-hmm. So he's saying dad's got history of this and this, and there's this here, and he's saying it's a very tentative statements. In the father's case, father's admitting to thus and such, but could be evidence of is not the same as diagnosing. You know, if language means something, then he didn't provide a diagnosis. When the father admitted to history of and difficulty in a couple diagnostic areas, that's noted that father came from father, and that also coming from father is a history that may suggest, or it's very tentative language. I don't like it. Can't be any more clear than that. But, you know, there's evidence of an underlying condition that needs to be evaluated is the consultation I would have made. And he took it a step farther, evidence of, and I've seen in many reports, as you may have reviewed, even conditional stuff like that. There may be evidence of this or that, or rule out this or that. And quite frankly, this is another common way of saying rule out this, as opposed to this is what it is. And I think there's a big difference between making a statement to rule out something and to say this is what's going on. So.
But with the, okay.
I think the point is that with Ms. Shreve's perspective of this looks like a diagnosis, I understand in language and as professionals, we understand that you've put limitations and conditions on that. The way it comes across to the general public is that you gave a diagnosis.
Well,
that's the, right. What I see as the concern.
Well, and going back to the APA code, it says, you know, to render an opinion, doesn't even use the word diagnosis. Psychologists explain that this is, you know, that's, this isn't, you know, it's an opinion. It's very concerning to me that you listen to one side and this is, instead of saying, yeah, there might be an evaluation, you're like, well, it could be based on all this, this evidence of this personality disorder, where there's no, I mean, based on what someone has said, instead of, I mean, there's a lot of different disorders. There's a lot of, there's no medical history in here. There's no, there, and he clearly says there's the person had never been to a, you know, mental health facility or anything. It's just, I guess it's concerning to me that you could go to someone and they, and then you kind of write up and you're like, well, when you read that, that's pretty much what it feels like. Well, it could be evidence of this. And that's from a professional person, right? That could be, I guess I have strong concerns about that.
May I add something?
No, not at this point. This is a, yeah, we're in deliberation, sorry. So.
The kind of thing that comes to me on a routine basis from other professionals is, I'm concerned it might be this, I'm concerned this might be here. We hear that on routine referrals, when a patient's being sent to me, when a physician sends a patient to me, you know, and you look at this, I'm concerned about thus and thus. So between professionals, that happens all the time. It's not a consultation that's written for the lay public.
Well, and it's not a consultation. This was written for the courts.
Mm-hmm.
So from doctor to doctor, I think that you're right. Maybe that's more of a accepted way, but when you're writing it for the courts with the intention of litigation, to me this is a much, it's a very strong statement.
I mean, I agree, it's concerning. I don't feel that it violates the strict language of our ethics code. I think it's sloppy and concerning, like you say, but I don't see a major violation here.
What's concerning that even the judge brought it? I mean, the judge was concerned about it. I mean, I think that it's, well, you look at this and it's, to me it is, and it's very strong opinion based on very little information. So.
I agree with Dr. Myers on his statement.
I mean, there is the issue of informed consent as well. I mean, it's stated in the report then that consent was obtained. That's not sufficient. I don't know how this committee's typically handled that when it's been noted and addressed already moving forward. So I'm curious about previous decisions on that.
You know, most cases folks come prepared with, here's what I've done, here's what I've modified, this is my paperwork. So yelling at them and saying you've got to do this or take some continuing education in it or something, they've already done it and they hand it to us.
Right.
I saw no evidence of the change here. So That is both the, I think, lack of experience, if someone's never had a complaint before, you know, the legal preparation for it is that if you're admitting to something you don't have, but you're testifying that you've done X, Y, and Z to do it, show me. That would have been much more comforting to me. So I'd at very least ask for evidence of that. I mean,
we can't ask for evidence if we don't move forward.
No, I'm going to ask a legal question from our distinguished Attorney General. At a complaint screening level, can they accept a letter of concern without it going to the board? Or does it have to go to the board?
It would have to go to the board. And you can make a recommendation to the board that they offer a letter of concern. But you can't resolve it at this level with a letter of concern.
So all you can do is dismiss or...
Mm-hmm.
Or
the lawyer.
I wonder if we could write a... Damn, I get that. And then if we ask him, he'd probably tell us it's the one case out of the last 600 that you don't have a signed consent for. And that's a very unfortunate situation.
All right, so I think what I'm hearing is both of you do not feel strong about going forward with the concern with the report. Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. And the concern was the consent form, which they've said they've updated. You want to clarify that?
So
just the consent form situation.
Yes. The consent forms themselves always existed and always were provided to the patient. It was just a matter of how that process was happened. So it's not as though I could come and show you a revised consent form. It's just a matter of I could explain to you that it's now provided to patients in the waiting room before they see Dr. Mastikian. And when they come in, they already have the forms. And most of the time now, that we have two people now that are making sure that the consents are signed. And as I explained before, this was an isolated incident. The consents always existed.
So it's the process has changed.
The process has been slightly revised that now Dr. Mastikian doesn't present the forms upon seeing the patient, but they are given the forms in the waiting room, usually signed in the waiting room. If they, for some reason, have any questions and they don't sign the consents in the waiting room, that's the first thing that Dr. Mastikian is informed of by his assistant when they come in, saying, before we get started, we need to talk about the consents and have you sign them. And there was verbal and implicit consent in this case, which was noted in the report, but there is, I understand.
Well, that would make me, how is there verbal consent if we never got to discussing the consent form and signing it?
It wasn't signed, it was discussed with CH.
So it was never signed?
Correct.
Right, it was just discussed.
Ms. Galvin indicated another option would be to table this until we get additional evidence.
Then she stated that there would be no additional evidence because there's no evidence that the process has changed. And there was no form in
there's
this
no
case.
Form. So is there a motion?
No.
I guess it comes down to what I'm hearing is the consent form issues. That do you take that forward or not?
It's consent's a huge issue. For years, all we did was verbal consent. There's evidence of verbal consent in the documentation that's provided in the report. The procedure should be to sign the damn thing. The attorney tells us they've changed the procedure and done that. What else are we going to force on them? It's to say, you know, there are two things that are serious, which I think is a teaching moment for you and a practice moment. We all get busy with 1,000 cases and do things quickly but I'm willing to move to dismiss this and say, never want to see it again here.
And I would say that I have really strong concerns about it, about the report, about how it's presented in a litigation situation. It wasn't asked for by the judge. It was, you know, in the, and again, it was very, from the layman's term, it did, you know, looks like a diagnosis, smells like a diagnosis. It's, you know, it has that characteristic. And I think that that's concerning, I think, especially from the general public standpoint. So if it was me, I'd move it forward, but I think what I'm going to hear is a motion. Did I hear a motion? Uh-huh. Did you make a motion?
Yes.
Oh, we have a motion.
I'll second.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion carries. So the case will be dismissed. Again, thank you for coming today. We do appreciate it. All right, moving on to our last case, complaint number 1910, Dr. Shelley Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman, are you on the line? Let me see.
I am, ma'am.
All right. And the complaint is also on the line EL. We're using initials. The complainant EL, are you on the line?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to first start with a summary of this case, and then I will be asking EL to provide some statements if she would like to. So first, Dr. Myers, would you like to provide a summary?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the complainant, Dr. Kaufman, who is also licensed as an LPC, provided therapy sessions, 14 sessions to EL in between 2017 and 2018. In June 2019, EL submitted a complaint alleging multiple issues that occurred during therapy. The complaints were that a year and a half ago, EL began seeing Dr. Kaufman on a weekly basis for approximately 5 months. Shared that she was struggling with a variety of issues, and that EL did have some experience in the field of counseling. And that she was concerned about the services that she received from Dr. Kaufman. She mentions that she was provided EMDR that was useless and possibly harmful to her, that there was a lot of discussion during sessions that weren't related to the presenting problems, and that there were some inappropriate references to the complainant's husband, as well as some misguidance on relationships. The other concern, primary concern, was that there was no treatment planning, that Dr. Kaufman would not disclose her diagnosis to the complainant, and that finally the most serious concern was that EL was reported in her final session that she was feeling suicidal and needed additional help. She did not feel that she was given an appropriate referral and was abandoned in the therapeutic relationship. Dr. Kaufman responded in a timely manner and did not agree with the concerns that the complainant brought about events that occurred in therapy, explained that a treatment plan was in place, and that the issues that were discussed seemed to be relevant for the presenting problems, and that an appropriate referral was made, and that she was merely would not be providing services for the claimant while the complainant was receiving treatment at a higher level of care, and that it was up to the complainant to reach back out to Dr. Kaufman. And that concludes my summary.
Great. Thank you, Doctor. All right. EL, you're on the line. If you would like to provide a brief summary and opening statement. We've read all...
Is it my understanding you've all read the...
Oh, yeah. We've read all of the material. And you don't... This is your opportunity. You don't need to provide any comments if you don't want to. We just wanted to offer you an opportunity to make any comments.
I just want to say that what I wrote in the letter is absolutely true, and that my primary concern is for clients moving forward that may also have this experience. As a licensed professional counselor up until recently myself, for many years, especially that last session, my husband was there. He was present. The referral was to my physician's assistant because I was asked to get a doctor that would see me that day on the phone. It was really, the whole situation was very poor, and I just would like to say I think my letters can speak to that pretty well. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, and again, we appreciate you joining us today. Dr. Kaufman? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. EL, I'm sorry. We have some questions for you, if you don't.
All right.
Okay, Dr. Bohansky, would you like to start?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the course of treatment you received.
Yeah.
It seems to suggest that you went in with specific needs and expressed those to Dr. Kaufman.
Correct, which were primarily grief and adjustment and some marital concerns.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that instead of addressing those needs, Dr. Kaufman chose to try to take you back to childhood trauma or some such thing and do trauma therapy? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Yes. As I shared with her, I was physically abused by my mother as a young child. I knew this. I've been in treatment for this. I have worked it out. My mother is deceased. We've made peace.
Okay.
I was asked for 4 to 5 weeks to look at the dot going back and forth, and that I was instructed I would be doing that until I no longer teared up when I thought about being abused as a three-year-old. That eventually just went away, and then we spent the next 4 or 5 weeks talking politics. And that wasn't helpful. So
that's with Dr. Kaufman?
Yes. There were many sessions where it was just politics, and while I appreciated that we were on the same page, part of the issue was that I didn't want to lose my marriage, and my husband had very different political ideas, and it was causing some friction in our marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also just lost my father and mother, and yeah, I just needed some help.
And did you tell her it was not helpful and you needed something different?
I really wanted to just trust, having been a counselor myself for so many years, I didn't want to put that counselor hat on. So I just went with whatever she wanted. When I asked her what my diagnosis was, I knew that was bad and she wouldn't tell me.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Myers, any questions? All right. All right. Thank you very much, EL. We may come back with you. Right now, I want to move on to Dr. Kaufman.
All right.
Thank you. Dr. Kaufman, are you on the line?
I am.
All right. And also, is your attorney, Mr. Strubel, on the line?
Yes, this is Charles Strubel. I am on the line.
Right.
And I would like to make a statement.
Okay. If you could just first, both of you introduce yourselves officially for the meeting.
Yes. Yes. Charles Strubel, attorney for Dr. Kaufman.
Kelly Kaufman.
Great. Thank you. And thank you both for being here. Mr. Strubel, you said you had some opening comments?
Yes. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I know I'm going to sound like a lawyer, but the 30 years plus of training is hard to reverse. The way I look at this case, again, from a lawyer's perspective, this is a classic she said issue where the credibility of the two participants, Dr. Coffin and EL, is the key. And the first issue that I have to address as a lawyer is burden of proof. In other words, to find a violation, the board must find it more likely than not that complainant's version is more accurate than Dr. Coffin. There are several problems with that, but probably the most telling thing of all is Dr. Coffin's notes basically correlate with everything Dr. Coffin wrote in a response and is consistent with what she believes happened there. So we have this internal consistency with Dr. Coffin's notes and her response. Contrast that with inconsistencies by the complainant. She says that my main issue with Dr. Coffin is that her relationship with Dr. Coffin, what happened, caused her to stop practice and give up her license. The facts are that EL was not really practicing at the time she went to Dr. Coffin and said during treatment that she didn't think she would ever be able to go back to practicing. So that's inconsistent. She claims that she didn't need to deal with childhood issues, but the second session, she specifically was given the option to trace the first memory of the traumatic event, which is part of the EMDR case conceptualization recommendations, and she chose to talk about her mother, the fact that her mother was physically and emotionally abusive to her. That was the patient's choice, and probably a correct choice. Then she says that she successfully processed these memories. However, when asked about it, she said that the current subjective disturbance level of these childhood trauma events was 6 out of 10, which means there was significant disturbance or trauma that was still lingering. So that's inconsistent. The complainant also says that the reason why she made this complaint against Dr. Coffin is other. The question then becomes, why then, if that was such a concern, did she wait a year and a half to make such a complaint? The other thing that I wanted to mention was you have to take into consideration of the fact that the complainant talks about Dr. Coffin not handling a suicidal ideation or concern appropriately. You need to know what her background is. She deals with treating first responders for many governmental agencies and private, including Phoenix Children's Hospital, the City of Phoenix Police Department. She's the mental health advisor for the Mesa Police Department, critical incident advisor for the Gilbert Police Department. She also works with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, specifically the Sex Crime Unit and Crimes Against Children Unit. She's been approached by Homeland Security, as well as the City of Peoria. This is a lady who has practiced successfully for 42 years, and you saw the letter of reference from the psychiatrist who actually referred EL to Dr. Coffin. You have to take all these things into consideration in dealing with the credibility issue, which unfortunately is the issue that has to be decided. Dr. Coffin's notes specifically document everything she did appropriately. And I don't know how you could deal with the burden of proof any other way.
All right. Thank you for those comments. Are there any questions from the board?
Dr. Coffin, have anything to say?
Dr. Coffin, do you have any comments?
No.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the board?
Yes.
Dr. Myers.
Dr. Coffin, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Coffin, this is Dr. Meyer. My concern is, first of all, is about the treatment records. Your attorney suggested that your documentation provides a level of evidence for your perspective on all of this, but when I read through the notes, almost every single note has the exact same mental status exam, as well as, there was another section, the session characteristics. So session characteristics and mental status exam are exactly the same session after session. You talk about your evidence or the treatment plan of using EMDR to treat the diagnosis and report a couple of scales that you're going to use to demonstrate improvement, but there's no record of scores or was there any improvement. So can you explain to me why there was absolutely no change through the sessions up until the second to the last one?
What I would respond with, sir, respectfully, is that I rated session characteristics and mental status each time the patient came to see me independently. The fact that they turned out to be the same is my assessment. That's how things work each time.
Okay, but like the same typos are in there. When you talk about session content, one session talks about a reported anxiety, and yet that didn't make it down into the mental status, which just says affect is sad, mood is depressed every single time, regardless of what you actually note as occurring.
The record reflects what I observed, sir.
Okay, so this isn't a template that just carries over every time?
There is a template available in the software, but I think carefully about everything before I assign a remark.
So you retyped each mental status exam for each session?
Ask me that again, please.
So you retyped the mental status exam for each session?
Yes, I do. It asked, the software asks me to answer each question independently, and I do.
Okay. Did you, for your treatment plan, did you assess her using the SUDS and the VOC scores and record those scores anywhere?
I did not specifically record those each and every time. I don't always do that.
So how do you document improvement or not?
Based on what the client is telling me, what she's reporting, and what I see.
But how do you document that?
What I write is in front of you.
Can you be specific?
I'm not sure what you're asking me. I'm sorry.
Okay. So your treatment goal is to achieve a 0 SUDS and a 7 VOC scores on psychosocial trauma issues identified along with a clean body scan. She will achieve mild to minimal ratings of associated symptoms per her report. That's mentioned at the bottom of every progress note. And
that's right.
And then it says, for the progress towards a goal, it says some progress as evidenced by patient report. But again, it's every time you say some progress, but how often did you administer those scales that are part of your treatment plan?
Once a month. Each and every time, but I did not record the actual number.
Okay. And is there a reason that you don't report those?
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I would be hard pressed to tell you why I didn't in this case. I most certainly wish I had, as I look back.
Okay. And then, could you walk us through the last session where the complainant was concerned about suicidal ideation? What steps you took to refer her?
Well, when a licensed professional counselor tells me that she is suicidal, the appropriate thing, in my opinion, after 42 years of professional practice, is to have her properly evaluated for boosted level of care.
So did you do that? Did you provide that evaluation?
No, because that, if she's telling me that she's actively suicidal, then the next step would be to get her someplace safe where she could be evaluated and treated.
And what did you do to get her to a safe place?
Well, her husband agreed to take her to a facility.
Okay. So there was agreement on your client and her husband that they would take her directly to a specific facility?
That is what my memory is telling me. That's what I normally do. Sometimes I go to the facility with the patient.
But what did you do in this case? Did you refer them to a specific facility?
No, she
didn't. I'm not recalling, honestly, sir. And of course, the facility that is selected is usually based on the contractual relationship between the insurance company and the facility.
But you don't facilitate that in any way?
I most certainly do.
In what way did you facilitate it in this situation?
I just don't recall. I would never have let her leave without a clear understanding of what the next steps were going to be.
Okay, and then did you follow up with her to determine whether she made it to a facility or that she was in a safe place?
My general practice is to ask the patient to please remain in contact with me as that process continues until I know that everything is okay.
So it's the suicidal client's responsibility to follow up.
So it just depends on, everyone is different. Sometimes I go with that person and sit with them for hours and hours in the facility until I'm sure that she was with her husband and she's a licensed professional person who told me that she was prepared to go directly and I took her at her word.
Okay, and was there any work to get a release and submit the client's records to the treating facility?
I normally call the facility depending on who it is once a release has been signed, and the facilities always get releases and requests the records.
So, and in this case?
They did not. What I was explaining to Ms. Levine was that I couldn't follow her, What I was explaining was that, I knew she would well know, that I couldn't follow her in her treatment at the hospital.
Okay, and did you have any further contact with her after she left your office that day?
Not to my recall.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
Dr. Bohansky?
What electronic progress note program do you use?
DocuTrack.
And is that a check mark entry answer kind of thing that generates progress notes for you?
Some of it is check mark and some of it is open-ended questions that requires a response.
But it generates the paragraphs based upon your check marks?
Some of it. Some of it is based on what I write.
So when you get a situation that's a crisis situation and the program isn't necessarily designed for the actual things that you do, you provide no documentation of the extraordinary efforts you've made to assist somebody.
I'm sorry.
Is that a question?
One moment.
Please tell it.
Okay. Yes, I do document. It just depends on the situation. And if I didn't document enough in this case, then I have to stand with what the record is that I wrote at the time.
Yeah, that appears to be what we have. And it may not reflect accurately the work that you actually did, Doctor.
No, that's likely the case because it's virtually impossible to write down every single thing that a psychologist says and does.
Absolutely true. I think it's probably just the important ones that we want to keep track of.
I agree with you 100%. So.
Good. Thank you. That's all I have.
So just to clarify, the session notes or the mental status notes, because they are, I noticed that too, they're all the exact same paragraph every time. That's made from a checking mark, just checking different things off, and then it just slaps it in there.
All right, so let me explain how that works. The section comes up on mental status, and there is a question, please respond to this aspect of mental status, that aspect of mental status. And what I do is make an entry based on that individual question. She, in my opinion, her mental status remains consistent throughout the treatment.
Okay. And Dr. Myers, you have another question?
Yes, one other question. Is the consent form not part of your electronic health record?
No, it is.
So why is there not a consent form in this case?
Oh, okay. So the reason why there's not a consent form signed in front of you is one of two possibilities. I routinely, of course, get consent and review that form that you have in front of you. When dealing with police, fire, people in the professional community, I don't spend a paragraph by paragraph amount of time reviewing informed consent because these professionals already know the issues that are involved. They are experts in their fields, and they do understand informed consent and the law with respect to confidentiality of records, electronic records, how to get a hold of me, all of the issues related to informed consent. And so when I have them sign, they sign it, and they're welcome to take it home. They're welcome to ask me any question at any subsequent time in treatment. My general experience with civilians as well as with the professional community is that they don't spend a lot of time reviewing that document. They're interested in getting relief. But I either have misfiled hers or, God forbid, it was not signed, and it's not at all like me not to have someone sign something like that. That's the first thing that we do. I diligently went through my file several times to try to find it, and I was not able to do so, but I still wanted you to have a copy of what it is that I review with patients. And I'm always available to answer any questions that people have about all of the content contained in the informed consent. Almost no one ever takes me up on a lengthy discussion about anything in that informed consent.
Okay, so it's your consent form is not part of the electronic health record, or it is?
Well, I guess I don't know what you mean by electronic. It's not part of the DocuTrack clinical program, if that's what you're asking. No, that's separate and independent that I got in consultation, like all of us do, with the American Psychological Association Insurance Trust and all the trainings that I go to. I'm at that training every year to stay abreast of friends in the field with respect to these issues.
So you have
it's paper.
You have a paper case, a paper chart, and the progress notes in a separate electronic health record. Is that correct?
I keep the informed consent in paper. I can upload it into the patient's electronic medical record, but I don't often do that. I'm just too busy.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions? No. Okay, hearing none, we'll go into deliberations. Thank you, Dr. Kaufman, for participating. Deliberations is a time for the committee to speak amongst ourselves without any interruptions from any of the participants. Dr. Myers, you are the lead. Would you like to start the discussions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I see significant concerns here. About practice of care, no consent, not maintaining adequate records. I also have concerns about the treatment that was provided and the lack of evidence of any support for a suicidal client. I know that when I have somebody that has suicidal concerns, after the fact, I spend hours documenting every single thing. To have no mention of that, to put the burden on the client to deal with this, it seems like gross incompetence to me. So before I give a motion, any other thoughts?
It's rare that I feel insulted at a meeting. And I guess for 40 years, doctor has done wonderful work for lots of people. She has a reputation, or so we've been told, and for working for first responders, I thank her, and that must be a wonderful and good feeling. I also agree with her attorney that looking at consistency is an important kind of thing. And this is consistently bad. And that there's probably not any other way to state that, is that this record reflects nothing to me about what happened with this patient. And those things that are important, and doctor may have responded perfectly well to her. I don't know, because it's not there. Apparently it wasn't part of the program where you could check it. So I can't tell you what she did. The things that would change from session to session, the rating scales, are chosen not to be filled in. The things that didn't change are there consistently, and the attention is to that detail. There are good and bad session recording things, but there's no substitute for writing a summary about what's actually happening with the client, what the progress is, what the change in the treatment plan is, and where you're going. The assumptions that, you know, when someone goes to a therapist, when I go to a therapist, the assumption isn't I'm a professional and therefore they can skip X, Y, and Z. The assumption is I'm a client and I'm in distress. And clients in distress, by the way, don't remember all the things that they're supposed to remember, like all the things about confidentiality and consent and informed information and crisis stuff. When you're in distress, you're in distress. At least that's my experience in treating people who have been in distress. And as such, I treat them like a vulnerable person in distress. And I assist them in making decisions, and I follow through with those decisions to make sure they're good ones and they end up in a safe place. And if it's somebody I've seen for a significant period of time and they end up in the hospital, I would certainly be following up with them and not assuming that because they had an educational background that they would follow up with me. You know, there's just a consistent twinge throughout this whole thing of significant lack of what I think of as a therapeutic alliance, and almost one of and so there's concern and you know, to suggest because you use an electronic record that's a pre-formatted thing that has been at some point recommended by the old APA, the old insurance company APA used to use, there's still an option in that to customize it, to actually give us information, provide the chart with information, record the information that's of significant note. And I agree, a mental status exam can be the same from session to session. That's not there. But that's not the important thing that I want to, unless I'm dealing with a cognitive declining client. The thing I'm concerned about is in fact the content and progress toward the specified individualized goals. And I see none of that in this record.
I would agree with both my colleagues. And from a person from the general public, I find it, the lack of documentation is very concerning. The lack of someone who's suicidal and not having all the information of what this person did to help them, or following up or to telling them to contact them when they're better, or, you know, when they're, that just doesn't make sense to me. So I have very strong concerns and feel that this should be moved to the board. We have a motion.
So I would move that complaint number 1910 be referred to the full board for review of a possible violation of ARS 32-2061-A16 for sections E, gross negligence in the practice of a psychologist, H, failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, or professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient, and V, abandoning or neglecting a client or patient in need of immediate care without making suitable arrangements for continuation of the care.
And can you accept a friendly amendment? R, failing to obtain client or patient's informed or written consent.
No.
So include R, and then I also had potentially O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards or practice. Would that fit?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, do you accept those amendments? Do you want legal advice?
Yeah, could we do legal advice?
Do you want, okay, yes. Do I have a motion to go into executive session?
For legal advice.
For legal advice.
So motioned.
Okay, I got a motion. I got a
second.
All in favor? Aye. All right, we're going to step out of the room quickly.
They can stay on the
you
phone.
Stay, please stay on the phone. We're going to actually physically move to a room next door. We'll be back in,
as soon as we can.
The regular session. And if I could just summarize what I, did you accept my amendment?
So yes, I would accept that amendment for, what is it, R?
So, R and B. So what I believe I have now from is a violation of ARS 32-2061-16E, Gross negligence for practice of psychologist. H, failing to refuse to maintain and retain adequate business and financial or professional records pertaining to psychological services provided to a client or patient. O, which is providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging.
No, I didn't have that.
Or engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards or practices. That was one of my amendments.
Got it.
So are you okay with that amendment?
Yeah.
I felt that the practice was unprofessional by current standards.
Okay, yeah.
And then we had R, failing to obtain client or patient informed or written consent to release personal or otherwise confidential information to another party unless the release is otherwise authorized by law. And then I think the final one was V, abandoning or neglecting a client or patient in need of immediate care without making suitable arrangements for continuation of care.
Okay, so I actually don't know that R fits, because this is about releasing confidential information. It's not about just obtaining informed consent. Am I reading that correctly?
You can go to DD, which is violation of the ethical code, and tie that into the ethical code that requires you to obtain informed consent,
which is 9.
So DD, and it the ethical code provision is 3.10.
So I think that fits better than R, because R is about if you release information.
I would agree with you.
Okay.
Okay, so then you're saying
so
that.
So then add DD.
Okay.
As it relates to 3.10.
All right, so just to summarize, we have ERA 32-2061. We have E, H, O, V, DD, and that's for violation of ethical code 3.10, informed consent. Is that the motion?
I would amend my motion to include all that.
And do I have a second? Dr. Bohansky's seconding it. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. The motion goes forward. Both parties will be receiving information down the road from our staff in regards to the next steps. Thank you for coming and participating in today's meeting. That concludes all the items on our agenda. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So motioned.
Second. Okay, I've got a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. And before I say we're done, thank you, staff. Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Galvin, our Attorney General. We really appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, for joining.